This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today is the Friday recap where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week. Up first, we'll hear from Health Equity reporter Farah Yousry about growing divisions between school boards and parents.
You may have heard a feature story on air last week from Farah Yousry, Health Equity reporter for Side Effects Public Media, about growing divisions among school leaders and parents during the pandemic. We're now joined live with Farah to talk more about that story and to find out what she heard in her weeks working on the feature. Welcome back to the program, Farah.
Thanks, Miriam.
How did the idea for this story come about?
Yeah, so the idea started when I saw a video of a physician at a school board meeting here in Mount Vernon, Indiana. He was very eloquent, used scientific terms, and, you know, felt legit. He was talking about COVID, vaccines, and masks. But after journalists and medical experts checked, turns out part of what he was saying was, in fact, misinformation that could discourage people from getting vaccinated or having kids wear masks at school. Still, the video went viral in a matter of hours. It was picked up by some national media, as well as other social media accounts. It got millions of views in a matter of days. And that's something very extraordinary for a school board meeting, let me tell you that. I mean, typically just 10 to 15 people attend school board meetings. Things are very low-key. But recently, school board meetings have been looking like battlegrounds. Hundreds of people and protesters show up in many of these meetings across the country with big flags and signs. School board members are sometimes attacked and verbally abused and intimidated. And so I felt that school board meetings now are turning into a place where, you know, people can spread health misinformation, a place where people take their political frustrations and really hurt other people who normally would just be their friends or next door neighbors, you know.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you mentioned how these are usually low-key meetings, but now I guess, you know, there's public comment time. I'm assuming that's when folks can just say whatever they want to say without
exactly
anybody checking them. What was that experience like for you to just go from a low key meeting to one that was a lot more active?
Yeah, I mean, it's surprising, very surprising. And usually those school board members are, you know, they're unpaid volunteers. They're elected by the community. They represent the school district they live in. They're nonpartisan and non-political. You know, these races are not partisan. And so usually school board members are former teachers, parents, grandparents, you know, sometimes university professors who study education or public policy. And so for them to be faced with this kind of rage and anger and, you know, aggression, I mean, it's something for sure. It's out of the ordinary.
Yeah, and as you're bringing up that point that they're nonpartisan, they're volunteers who are, you know, taking these positions, running for these positions, that must be pretty tough. I mean, and I'm wondering if a lot of folks may not even realize that there's somehow, you know, if somebody gets voted into something, there's an assumption that they're part of, I don't know, the system in some way. Mm. So what is the role of a school board member?
Yeah, so normally school boards have 5 to 9 members, and they base their decisions on input from the superintendent, from families, teachers, students, and the general community. And they're usually in charge of discussing issues like budgets, school policies. So these are people, like you said, who took it upon themselves to be in this position to do their civic duty and what's in the best interest of the school kids in their communities. And for sure, there could be some of them who are taking this position as a stepping stone into a career in local or national politics somehow. But that's absolutely not the common scenario. Most of them are not concerned with ideology or politics when it comes to their roles on these boards.
Well, we've been hearing about, you know, school boards all across the country and even here in the state becoming combative. What is the fighting generally about?
You're right. So school board meetings are becoming very combative. And you can have a taste of that in this coming soundbite, which you'll hear is a video uploaded on Twitter from a school board meeting in Tennessee. Protesters are surrounding the car of one of the speakers at the meeting and threatening him.
We know who you are. We know who you are.
Keep it calm.
No more masks.
Keep it calm. Keep it calm.
No more masks.
We're on these guys' side. They're
no.
on our side.
No, they're not.
Yeah, so you can hear, like, we know who you are. We know where you live. We're not on the same side, you know. So these are like small communities which are, I mean, they're close-knit. These people are neighbors and friends, like I said before. And so as for what the fight is about, it's mainly parents objecting to COVID safety policies and specifically kids wearing masks in schools. And the reason they're fighting with their local school board members about this is that as of now, there are no federal or state mask mandates in Indiana and in many other states. And so what the CDC and health departments did was they issued lots of guidance and information recommending masking up in schools, but not mandating it. So now what's happening is that health departments are saying this is going to be a local decision and school boards will be tasked with it. So now school boards are finding themselves in the crossfire. They need to make public health decisions in the middle of a raging global pandemic. And they need to do that as masks have become such a divisive issue now. You know, some parents don't want the school boards to require students to wear masks, no matter what the infection rate is. And so they're showing up at these board meetings. And I have to say, some of them are respectful. They're there to deliver their point of view. But others seem to cross a line. And I spoke with many board members from different states, and they tell me they get hate mail, threatening calls, and even people showing up at their doorstep. And that's been a recurring scene across the country, not just in Indiana.
And that's got to be tough to deal with, because you want to make the right decision for your school environment, but you also have to balance, I guess, you know, the parents and stuff. Well, we do have a soundbite you got from the Lafayette School Corporation. Can you help set this up and who we're going to hear from?
Yeah, so this is Les Huddle. He's the superintendent of the Lafayette School Corporation. And he told me it was much easier to require masks last year when there was a state mask mandate.
I'm not sure school corporations are in a winning situation. You know, you try to approach problems and look for a win-win solution. Again, with the opinions and, you know, we can all find our own facts. We can all find our own medical experts to support or not support our side of masks. It just comes down to that there is no win-win situation. This is a win-lose for some people.
That's a powerful statement that there's no win-win. It's a win-lose for some people.
Yeah. They're I mean, it's a sense of people don't feel they're on the same side anymore, you know, and it's taking this fight is taking on more meaning. It's not just about public health anymore. For some people, it's about politics, you know, and so that's making the role of these board members all the more harder, you know.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a sense of hopelessness and it seems like these fights are not going to be resolved in these meetings. Is that the impression you got, or does it seem like there's common sentiment that this is just not going to be resolved?
Yeah, absolutely. But again, I need to point out that almost all of the school board members and superintendents I spoke with would talk about how hard the situation is, but in the same breath, they would be saying that they know that they have this responsibility and they took this responsibility and that they're bent on doing the right thing no matter what for the sake of the school kids. And in some states like Florida, for example, where the governor there actually banned mask mandates, the school board members of some districts defied the governor's order and required masks because they felt it's the right thing to do. But then school boards are finding themselves entangled in all these political and legal battles in the middle of a pandemic. So that's definitely changed the nature and role of school board members.
Have you seen this before, this kind of backlash towards school board members with other divisive issues?
Yeah, so school boards have had to weather similar heated debates before, like school prayer in the 1980s or sex ed in the early 2000s. And I spoke to several public policy professors who say that heated debates are not new. But what's different now is that political tribalism in the U.S. is at an all-time high. Add to that social media with all of its misinformation, and really you have yourself a perfect storm. You know, it's also important to point out one more thing. The COVID-19 pandemic is evolving and changing rapidly, and so is the guidance coming out of the CDC and health departments. And there's also an influx of small scope studies from across the world. So there are studies, for example, in Israel that say masks may not be so effective for kids, but then there are other studies in the US that say masks are important. So, you know, parents are understandably very confused and concerned, and some of them frankly, also are very political. And mask or no mask is becoming a different debate for them. That's no longer just about public health, but sometimes conspiracy and politics.
Right. And sometimes too much information is not a good thing, it seems like.
Exactly.
Yep. Well, we have a soundbite from Charlie Wilson, a school board member since 2007 in Worthington, Ohio, and the past president of the National School Boards Association, talking about elections, I believe.
I'm just surprised at how many people I hear from who have been board members for a long time who said, it's not worth it. I'm going to either resign or not run again this fall. And also, even more unfortunate, some people are running for single purpose reasons, not because they want to improve this, but they've got a single issue, whether it be critical race theory or masking or in-person learning or whatever.
So it sounds like this is like the new battlefield is a school board. Mm.
Yeah, and exactly. It will have an impact on elections. Some long-serving school board members like Charlie are saying that it's becoming so partisan that any decision they make is deemed political, and it will definitely anger one group of people. And so, you know, also many parents are not shy to say that they do not trust the CDC or any government health authority. And, you know, it's making these board members in a very difficult position. They have to fight a legal battle as well as a health battle in the middle of a pandemic, you know.
Right. And again, just worth mentioning, I think, is that these board members are volunteers. This isn't a paid job that they're doing.
Exactly.
And so as we get ready to wrap up here, are you hearing anything about solutions to these meetings getting so heated or these fights? Is there anything that can be done?
Well, as of now, there seem to be very little common ground, honestly. And with the Delta variant, the stakes are a lot higher now. The virus does not wait until we settle our differences, you know. And Delta is much more transmissible. Infection rates are higher. And so, you know, school board members are trying to do the right thing. But, you know, there doesn't seem to be like a solution that will make everyone happy at this point.
Right. I mean, I wonder if a mandate would solve things if the governor just came through with a mandate.
Some school board members say that. Again, they don't want to set the precedent that, you know, the federal government or the state would impose something on the school boards. But in this exceptional situation where it's a public health, you know, crisis that no one has seen something like it before, they say it might be reasonable if the state or the federal government would do that at this point.
Thank you so much. That was Farah Yousry, health equity reporter for Side Effect Public Media. You can find her recent story and all her work on sideeffectpublicmedia.org. Coming up, we'll hear from health reporter Christine Herman about efforts to get farmers to promote the COVID-19 vaccine. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob, and it's the Friday recap where we revisit a few conversations we had over the last week. Next up, health reporter Christine Herman tells us about efforts to get farmers to promote the COVID-19 vaccine. When we talk about vaccination rates across the country, oftentimes rural areas are noted to trail behind urban and suburban communities in fully vaccinated populations. But many have not lost hope in those rural communities. Some are now looking to farmers to be the trusted voices in their communities to encourage their neighbors to get the vaccine. To learn more about this, we're joined now by Christine Herman, reporter for Side Effects Public Media and Illinois Public Media, who recently worked on a feature on farmers being the key to boosting rural vaccination rates. Welcome to the program, Christine.
Thank you, Miriam. It's good to be here.
How did you find out that rural areas were having such low vaccination rates?
Yeah, well, this is something that's been pretty widely reported. If you're, you know, I'm sure people remember back, 10 months ago now when the vaccine was first, you know, rolling out late December of last year, early January, and healthcare workers and elderly people were first eligible. There were a lot of people kind of sounding the alarm about, you know, the mRNA vaccine. It's this two-dose vaccine. It needs ultra-cold temperatures, which maybe some rural areas, rural health departments that have been underfunded for decades, may not have those resources to be able to even store this vaccine. So there was a lot of concern at the start about access. And as you mentioned, you know, the concern now is more so about trust and lack of understanding and misinformation driving lower vaccination rates in rural areas because, you know, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine came out and it required cold temperatures, but not as ultra cold. And obviously there have been lots of efforts in various places to get the vaccine out. And now it's pretty widely available. You can say that there still could be access issues, but that's been less of a concern from the rural health experts I've talked to lately.
And when it comes to this particular angle that you took with the story, what compelled you to dig into this?
Yeah, so actually, I learned about the National Rural Health Association saying that they're going to team up or that they've started teaming up with the National Farmers Union to boost rural vaccination rates. And my ears perked up. I just sort of, you know, just started reaching out to talk to the folks who were kind of leading this at the national level. And I was like, you know, what's the idea behind this? And really, it's just that, you know, I mentioned trust is so important. And they were saying, really, it's because farmers in rural communities are sometimes some of the most trusted voices in those areas. So, you know, we've heard talk about and getting religious leaders on board to reach, you know, people in different faith communities. And so this was sort of another idea, another angle, another strategy that was being kind of approached at this national level. And I wanted to kind of dig in and see, okay, how is this actually playing out on the ground?
And what reasons did you come across? I mean, you mentioned earlier there's, you know, so much misinformation and things that are being spread. But when it comes to rural areas, is it the same misinformation that is preventing folks from getting vaccinated?
Yeah, that's my sense, because I did ask this question from, you know, I talked to several farmers in rural areas and I did ask them about this. And yeah, it is kind of a lot of the same that I'm sure people have heard about. You know, there even one farmer himself said, I've used vaccines in my animals, but even I was a little bit, you know, kind of wondering, like, how did they get the vaccine developed and out so fast? And he had concerns about safety and could it possibly be safe if it was rolled out so quickly? And of course, we know that, you know, scientists have been saying there were no safety corners cut in these clinical trials. The reason they were able to roll out the vaccine so quickly is that unlike previous vaccines, they started manufacturing these vaccines before the trials were finished so that if the trials showed they were safe and effective, they could immediately start administering the vaccines. And that's what we saw happen. But of course, you know, that was one concern I heard. And then, you know, the extreme is that there are conspiracy theories, as we all know, misinformation. And even the farmers themselves says it's hard to know who to trust when there's so much information coming from so many different places. And of course, the way this has become politicized so heavily, unfortunately, like all the other public health guidance throughout the pandemic, also the vaccine has become a politicized issue. So I think it's kind of the combination of all those factors, based on what I learned in my reporting.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when I hear from folks that are nervous because they say it's produced so quickly, I think it's just hard for us to realize how far technology has come, you know, in our time before the previous vaccinations that took so long. So it's like we have a lot of technology and good things on our end now that we can make use of.
Yeah. And I realize it's something that can be tricky to understand. I mean, I studied science before I became a journalist, so I knew what mRNA was. I knew what, like, delivery vesicles were. And I knew that this vaccine platform using mRNA had been in development for years before, SARS-CoV-2 came along. And so and I knew that genetic sequencing technology has been developed so rapidly. So when this new virus was sequenced, the vaccine companies that had already developed this technology for years, they were able to just quickly, you know, get that genetic code and drop it in and you know, pretty rapidly start doing testing on the safety and efficacy of the vaccine. So, but I understand that, you know, a lot of people don't have that understanding, and it's a lot to keep up with the science, and especially when you're trying to sort through, okay, well, you're saying this, but someone else is saying this, and how do I know who I can trust?
Absolutely. And your feature touches on that idea, as we've been talking, of farmers being the people that could boost vaccination rates in rural areas. We do have a clip here from a cattle rancher on his thoughts. Let's take a listen.
I think in our rural communities, I think about farmers or ranchers and families that have been there for generations. They are trusted, respected members of our communities. You know, everybody looks at Joe down the road and thinks, hey, you know, what might be his experiences on this topic or this issue, or kind of listens to what he or she may say. And so I think being able to involve those trusted members of our community, the older members of our community that have been there quite some time, has a huge impact in being able to share accurate information or address concerns in our rural communities. You know, I think on a day-to-day basis, you know, when I'm out looking at our cattle or taking care of them or whatever it might be, moving them from pasture to pasture, I might only see my neighbors, you know, across the fence line or when we're driving up and down the, you know, the rural roads. And so word of mouth still has a huge impact in how messages and information are shared in rural America.
That's an amazing sound bite there. Who were you talking to?
That's Ryan Goodman. He's a cattle rancher. He used to live in Colorado until fairly recently. He moved out to a rural part of Virginia. But he's actually been, you know, when he was back in Colorado, the Colorado Health Department reached out to him and asked if he would be willing to partner with them because he's pretty active on social media and on Instagram and Twitter. He's at Beef Runner. And they asked if he would be involved in just helping to promote the vaccine to his followers and also to his rural community. And so that's how he got involved and, you know, has been pretty active on that front.
And he mentioned that word of mouth still has a huge impact. I think maybe we often forget that because we're so wrapped up in social media and connecting in that way that we forget there's another way to connect.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's kind of like human nature. We when we're bombarded with information on a topic, like, you know, even me as a health reporter, I can't go read all the original research studies on every aspect and then do an assessment of all the information and then decide, okay, based on my thorough analysis, this is what I'm going to believe. A lot of us, every person, no matter where you are kind of on the left-right divide or politically or, you know, whatever it is, we rely on the people we trust to kind of, you know, help us know how to process information and even, you know, what to believe about things. And so that's, I think, the point he was making there, that even in rural communities, farmers are more trusted than sometimes even, you know, health experts, especially since, you know, if you tune into national media, they've got, you know, health experts from, you know, big cities, large academic institutions, and they're not from like our community. Like why should I trust that person? But it's like, oh, you know, he said Joe down the road, like, well, this is someone I can trust. And, oh, he's saying that, oh, you know, vaccines are, you know, effective at preventing illness. Oh, okay, well, maybe I'll give that some more thought. Even though I've been hearing that same thing, you know, maybe people have already been hearing that message, but when you hear it from a person you trust, it hits differently. I think that's sort of like the interesting, like, human psychology piece of this.
And another interesting thing I think is also that farmers are used to the term like herd immunity for their own livestock. And we do have a clip here from a farmer who talks about the importance of vaccines. Let's take a listen.
And being a livestock producer, I'm well aware of vaccinations and vaccines, and that's how we develop immunity in our animals. Beef animals and hogs, we're always vaccinating the breeding stock to pass on immunity to the little ones.
So does that give you a sense? First of all, I guess if you could tell us who that was.
Yeah, that was Tom Arnold. He's a cattle rancher, raises cattle, hogs, and chickens in Elizabeth, Illinois, which is a small rural town in the northwest corner of the state.
And so it sounds like, you know, farmers are aware of vaccinations and vaccines and the benefits of them. Is there any hesitancy towards vaccination because they feel like it's something more designed for animals than humans?
You know, I tried to get a general sense of, you know, since farmers understand vaccines and understand the science because of the work they do with animals, would that make them more likely to trust vaccines that were developed for humans? And, you know, there's really not good data on that. Like, farmers haven't been surveyed to ask their position on the vaccine. But the handful of people I talk to, you know, they understand the science. They know what's in a vaccine. They know how it works. And as you mentioned, they know why herd immunity is so important. If you can protect, you know, if you can get immunity in your herd of animals, even if the vaccine's not 100% effective, because none of them are, you know, it protects the ones who are either unvaccinated or, you know, who maybe have waning immunity. The more people who you can get immunized through the vaccine. So they understand the technology. They can explain that science part of it, which I think is why the National Rural Health Association was interested in particular in getting farmers on board, because not only are they trusted, but they have this knowledge, you know, kind of, you know, perhaps unlike most, you know, faith leaders who, you know, maybe didn't study science, but a lot of farmers do have that background and that knowledge. So they can speak to the technological component as well as kind of understand like rural values and where people are coming from and why they might be hesitant and how to talk with them.
Do farmers seem on board overall, the ones that you talk to, with promoting the vaccine in their communities, or are there some that are still hesitant?
Yeah. So, you know, even Tom, the guy you just heard, he was like, you know, I think, yeah, farmers are trusted, but also we're really busy. So he, you know, he told me that actually the main reason he hasn't been more active is, one, it is a little bit scary, even for someone like him, to talk about it because of how politicized it gets. He's like, I don't want to get into an argument with people. And a lot of people have already made up their minds, like, and there's no changing it. You know, and he said, like, you know, if people ask me, if it comes up, I'll mention, oh, I understand how vaccines work. And if they want to know more, he'll have that conversation. But he said a lot of times people don't ask. And, you know, it's interesting because the vaccine rollout has also overlapped with some of the busiest times for farmers, planting season in the spring. And then, you know, I'm not an ag reporter, so I can't speak to all the details, but this is what the farmers have told me. You know, it's been a really busy time the past year, especially since they're also kind of reeling from the effects of the pandemic economically on their industry. So, but, you know, others, you know, say that they do want to be more active. And so I think it kind of runs the gamut. And that's part of the reason why there's this campaign with the National Farmers Union. You know, they're trying to kind of nudge farmers to be a little bit more vocal. It doesn't have to be a big flashy thing. But even just these word of mouth conversations, they say, it's like sort of like the vaccine battle at this point is sort of going to be like one person at a time. Because a lot of people who are hesitant maybe can be nudged, but it's not going to happen from like people coming in and like, I don't know, like you can't shame people into changing their mind or call people ignorant, you know, for not getting the vaccine and think that that's going to work. It's really about relationship building and trust building.
Absolutely.
At this point.
If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Christine Herman, reporter for Side Effects Public Media and Illinois Public Media, about some feature reporting she's done on farmers and the COVID vaccine. Christine, have you seen farmers encouraging their neighbors to get the vaccine? I know you mentioned that they're just super busy right now. Have there been any other, I guess, efforts you've heard of or programs?
Yeah, so I should mention that there are like farmers who have been involved in trying to get their workforce vaccinated. So that's something I learned by talking with the National Rural Health Association. So a lot of farmers have agricultural workers, migrant farm workers that travel from place to place, sometimes from other countries, to come here and work on the farms. And I've met farmers who have, in prior reporting, who've been pretty active with trying to get those workers access to the vaccine. So every state kind of varied in terms of prioritizing where agricultural workers would be eligible for the vaccine. And at least in Illinois, Illinois was one of the states that they did put ag workers kind of high on the eligibility list, recognizing that they're essential workers and should have access to the vaccine. So there's definitely that happening in lots of different places. And you know, and also there's, you know, the extension programs, which I know a lot of land grant institutions will have like sort of outreach in rural areas. And there have been definitely efforts to reach out and, you know, and sometimes agricultural leaders and ag workers are involved in those programs. So there's also that sort of thing happening as well, place to place.
And you know, as we're talking about the pandemic having an impact, including in agriculture. We do have a clip from the vice president of advocacy for the National Farmers Union. Let's take a listen.
So many other factors, including shutdowns in processing facilities due to outbreaks in our communities, certainly had a big impact on farmers' farming operations and our marketing. So there's been so much upheaval in the agriculture economy and in our communities because of the pandemic. We need to start moving past that. And vaccines are the way towards that. And that's what our organization has been supporting.
And who is this that we just heard from?
Yeah, that's Mike Strands. He's the vice president of advocacy for the National Farmers Union.
And it sounds like, you know, everyone's on board with the vaccinations and seeing that it affected even, you know, processing facilities. And when there's outbreaks, everything has to be shut down. Does that seem like an impetus for more folks to pay attention to getting vaccinated?
You know, I think that's the idea behind the way they're trying to frame the message, for sure. You know, Mike explained to me that really getting farmers on board is also a matter of conveying that this is in your best interest to get as many people protected from the virus as possible to help, you know, to help the agricultural industry itself recover and heal and move forward. So that's definitely the idea behind this campaign and the message that they're trying to get across to farmers who are maybe like, why should that be my job? You know, I'm not a public health expert. So, you know, and also they put out this online toolkit, which I mentioned in my story, to try to, you know, provide farmers with resources, with talking points for how to have conversations with your neighbors who maybe are vaccine hesitant. Also with, they've even included a template for if you want to write an op-ed for your local newspaper and share some of your experience and your personal story. You know, they've got different ways they're trying to nudge people and farmers in particular to kind of be a little bit more proactive on this front without hopefully requiring too much of a heavy lift, understanding that this is not their job, that they have a full-time job in farming.
Christine Herman is a reporter for Side Effect Public Media and Illinois Public Media. Coming up, we'll learn about the latest efforts around redistricting reform with a group of advocates. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. Today is the Friday recap where we look back at some of our favorite conversations we had this week. Up next, we'll learn about the latest efforts around redistricting reform with a group of advocates. We're joined by Julia Vaughn, Policy Director at Common Cause Indiana, Barbara Bowling Williams, President of the NAACP Indiana State Conference, and Brandon Evans, Executive Director and co-founder of Hoosiers Organized, People Energized, or HOPE. Barbara, what impact has redistricting had on minority populations in Indiana?
Well, what has happened for the minority populations in Indiana is that we have certainly seen a major disconnect in having the issues that we support barely getting recognized at our state house. You know, that we've seen the disrespect that occurred earlier this year when legislators were not even willing to listen to their colleagues when they were representing constituents in an effort to try to get them to reason with respect to bills. And so when we have this, when there is such an overwhelming supermajority of legislators in the state house who don't care about the vote or the issues that people of color have, then we don't have people who are willing to even listen to us, much less, you know, be willing to debate the issues and to consider that there may be a different way to do things.
Well, how does a community how does the morale get lifted when these types of situations are impacting, for example, these redistricting and the negative impact? How do they keep going?
Well, how they keep going is that, like I say, when it has risen to the level, like I said, when I talked earlier about the disrespect that occurred in the House earlier, the people get mad. You know, they no longer are feeling defeated and feeling that, you know, that there's nothing that they can do, that they just have to take it. And they realize that, no, they don't have to take it, that they can speak up. And when they do, for example, then at that point, the legislators realize, oh, we've gone a little bit too far here, and they dial it back a little bit. But it shouldn't even have to, you know, rise to that level for our representatives to to have the respect that they are entitled to. They were elected. They're not down there representing themselves. They're down there representing thousands of people who voted to put them and send them there. So that's what happens. You know, you're going to have less confidence and cooperation with a system that people feel is unfair. They're not going to take it.
Right, right. And Brandon, what impact has redistricting had on voting or voter turnout?
In general, like we talked about before, it's had a pretty big impact, in fact. And as the years go on, it has a multiplying effect, right? And so Nate, the previous guest, was talking about how much younger the young growth in Indiana, or population growth. And as they grow up into the system, right, they know about gerrymandering. They're much more knowledgeable. As Julia and Barbara were talking about, like, this is a much more well-known issue, especially among young people right now than it used to be. And so they know, you know, if they live in a rural community, how much their vote actually counts or doesn't count, right? And especially if they're coming from a community of color, you know, Representative Cherish Pryor recently stated in an op-ed that, you know, partisan redistricting using political data only will only push communities of color, which are already dramatically underrepresented, further into the shadows. And I feel like that's how, you know, folks feel right now. They feel like they're being pushed into the shadows, that their votes don't count, right? But we do have a way of, you know, bringing back hope, you know, pun intended, right? and that is to implement independent redistricting committees in Indiana. You know, this would allow us to be repairers of the breach, as they say. It would allow us to step back or take a step back from the knife's edge our politics is always sitting on, you know, and it would allow us to kind of bridge some of these gaps and bring our communities back together on both sides of the aisle, I feel like. When you're not continually dividing people, but you're, you know, or cutting people apart, but you're sewing people together. I feel like that is the path forward that's going to take all of us. But one huge step forward locally we can do, even without federal help, is implement an independent redistricting committee for this process going forward.
Well, if you're listening live and have any questions or comments on the topic, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. We do have a question from Dorothy on Facebook, who asks, I am curious about what is fair in redistricting. If the maps increase the number of like people in a district, then how would that increase competition? Julia?
Well, it really is a delicate balance. You have to prioritize a criteria. So is it going to be compactness? If you do that, that's probably going to negatively impact the competitiveness of the district. Of course, if you emphasize competitiveness, that might negatively impact other factors like keeping communities of interest together. So, you know, we've opened this up to all Hoosiers. Our coalition, All In for Democracy, has created a public mapping website, and we're having a competition, putting up some cash prizes for the maps that we think will best represent voters and communities across Indiana. You can go to districter.org and check out the software. We're actually having a mapping demonstration via webinar tonight. You can get access to information about that on Common Cause Indiana's Facebook page. But it is a delicate balance. But the real heart of the issue, as Brandon was talking about, is you can't have the players also be the umpires. It's a difficult job, but it's particularly difficult if partisanship is your number one goal. So we think you need to consider these other more public interest focused criteria and have a multi-partisan group of people who won't be running in the districts in charge of the map drawing process. So we've created both of these opportunities going along with the public mapping website and mapping competition. We put together a parallel redistricting commission made up of 9 Hoosiers, very diverse set of voters from all over the state who have really been generating a lot of very useful public comment, generating a lot of public interest in this issue, because as everybody stated earlier, I think the days of the legislature being able to go behind closed doors, draw these maps in secret, and then just spring them on Hoosiers are over with. Too many people now understand how fundamentally important this process is, and they are demanding a seat at the table. So we certainly hope that our mapping competition will produce a set of public interest-oriented maps that we can use to compare against the legislative maps, and again, make a strong argument that we need a very different process for doing redistricting going forward in Indiana.
Well, you're all with different organizations doing this type of work. Barbara, what is the NAACP doing in terms of educating folks about this topic? Has there been anything done?
Certainly it has. From our national level, we've held webinars and conferences and speakers on this very issue, talking about it, explaining to people what it is, working very closely with our coalition partners, the All In for Democracy, going to public hearings, making sure that we make comments, we speak out, letting everybody know. So yes, NAACP, and their ongoing webinars and seminars that have been taking place and continue to do so on map drawing and on, again, even taking to the basics of redistricting 101, because we know that people come to the party at different times, and we don't want to assume that everybody is at the same level. And so we want to make sure that we accept people where they are and bring them up to where we need them to be.
Yeah, I mean, these are some pretty complicated topics. I mean, even for myself, I'm learning every time I talk about this on the program something new. How do you convince folks that this is something important to be a part of?
Certainly, when you're talking about it, when there are constant articles in the newspaper, when we tell them, we need you to be here at this this place and show up, because we need some numbers out there. And when they come, then we're educating them that they're listening, they're hearing what other people are saying, and they're becoming more and more engaged.
And Brandon, you're with HOPE, a new nonprofit that started earlier this year. Can you talk about the need for a group like yours and how your efforts relate to redistricting and gerrymandering?
Yeah, so when you look at the stats in Indiana, I think I mentioned this before, but we are consistently 42nd, 43rd, bottom 10 of the country when it comes to voter turnout. And so we know we have an issue and we can be better, right, in Indiana. And so step one for us is we kind of divide it into three buckets. Registration is our foundation, right? And so we want to meet voters where they're at. And so we want you to be able to register to vote in an easy and accessible way at your barbershop, at your favorite sandwich shop, at the place your boutique that you buy clothes at. And so we're taking a real Main Street USA type approach to this and meeting voters where they're at their churches, at their, places of worship. And so that is one way we do it. And then the second bucket is to engage those voters. Again, one of the things that came out of that statewide survey we did was that voters feel like voting in Indiana is very transactional. And part of that is impacted through gerrymander, honestly, but because, when you have a gerrymandered safe district, you don't have to campaign as hard and or you don't have to talk as an elected official. You don't have to talk to your constituents as much. And so a lot of people, the only time they're hearing from their elected officials is the month before, 2 months before an election. Right. And so they view this voting as largely transactional in Indiana. And so we wanted to take a much more year-round engagement or consistent engagement approach. And then the last bucket is mobilization, right? In the end, we just want more people to vote, period. And so regardless of the party you're affiliated with, regardless of the causes you're for, we feel that Indiana is much better representative if everybody has a say in who they're being represented by. And so, you know, we're not where we ought to be, and we're not where we want to be. But, you know, we are glad that we're heading a little bit in the right direction. Right. And so, and again, large steps like an independent redistrict committee would, you know, show a sign of a commitment to a shared future. You know, and that shared future is a choice we can all make. And we make that choice, we can build consensus, and then we can get stuff done.
Well, when it comes to lawmakers, as you mentioned, Brandon, in some areas where they don't have to campaign as much, what I wonder, Julia, is if a lawmaker doesn't have to campaign as hard and they can save money and they only need to pop up like a month before the election, what incentives are there for them to change this?
It's just public pressure. That's the only thing that's going to make a difference. We have to let legislators know that we're going to remember this issue next year. All 100 members of the Indiana House of Representatives are up for re-election in 2022. Half of the members of the Indiana Senate will be up for re-election. So we're going to remind them that this is an issue that Hoosier voters care about more than ever. And we're going to inform them that if you voted for maps that were drawn under a process that was opaque, that didn't give Hoosiers adequate time to study the maps and provide feedback, you know, that's our big concern right now. Legislators have said we might have 6 days at the end of September to participate in the legislative process over making these new districts law. That's not enough time for Hoosiers to really understand what's being proposed, how it's going to impact their communities, and provide that feedback to legislators. So I would just encourage everyone listening today, contact the legislative leadership, contact your own state legislators, and demand a transparent process that gives you adequate time to participate. Because that's really what's ahead of us, is a very rushed process to get this done before Hoosiers really recognize what's going on. But we're going to let lawmakers know that this is an issue that Hoosiers really do care about. And next year, when they are coming up for re-election, we will remind voters of who was in on the gerrymander and who refused to go along with it. So public pressure is unfortunately the only tool we've got in our toolbox. But, you know, I'm optimistic. This is my third round of redistricting now. And I can tell you, Hoosiers are far more engaged than they've ever been before. And lawmakers are hearing, you know, all of the public hearings that they held earlier this month were standing room only. And we had some Hoosiers really giving some outstanding public testimony, pleading with lawmakers, you know, democracy's on the line here. Another decade of no participation, no competition in Indiana elections will be bad for Indiana. And so we've got to turn this around. We can turn it around with fair maps, but the only way we're going to get fair maps is by using this comparison tool we have, the public mapping competition, and getting tens of thousands of Hoosiers calling, emailing, showing up at the state house, demanding a fair process that ends up with fair maps.
Before we wrap up here, Barbara, are you optimistic at all that reforms will take place?
I think that something's going to change. We're at this point not going to be, I don't feel comfortable making any kind of predictions as to what that will be, but I am optimistic that something will change.
And Brandon, how about you?
Yeah, you know, there's that saying, the difference between heaven and hell is the difference between faith and doubt. And I have a whole lot of faith in Hoosiers, honestly, and I think we can get this done. And lastly, I want everybody to check their registration, right? That's the first step in all of this. And so if you want to do that, you can go to withhopewewin.com and check your registration at our website.
All right. Well, I want to thank you all so much for joining us this afternoon. Julia Vaughn is the policy director at Common Cause Indiana. Barbara Bowling Williams is the president of the NAACP Indiana State Conference. And Brandon Evan is the executive director and co-founder of Hoosiers Organized, People Energized, or HOPE. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. And if you ever want to reach out to us, you can always find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.